From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Many, many small earthquakes have been recorded in California and Nevada this year. It's part of what's been a very active time in the Ring of Fire, which is the geological region around the Pacific Ocean where most of the world's earthquakes happen. Did you happen to see the report that there was a magnitude 6.2, then adjusted to a 6.3 quake off the coast of Oregon last week? One the same size happened the same day off the coast of Alaska. So we wondered what's going on. We reached out to Dr. Graham Kent. He's the Nevada director of the Seismology Lab at the University of Nevada, Reno. And he's on the phone with us right now. Hi, Dr. Kent. Glad to have you back on the program.
How's it going?
So what's happening in the Ring of Fire? And can you explain a little more about that?
Yeah, obviously many people are familiar with the Ring of Fire encircling the Pacific Ocean Basin, and there are a lot of subduction zones primarily, and so we get a lot of large earthquakes. The San Andreas fault line is kind of a rarity, being a strike slip. But in fact, at least on the eastern part of the Ring of Fire, it's been pretty quiet, other than a little bit of chatter as we normally get, notwithstanding the Blanco fracture zone earthquake.
Oh, since you mentioned the Blanco zone fracture, that is where this Oregon earthquake that I just mentioned happened. Yeah. Say more about that one.
Yeah, that's basically a very active region offshore. It kind of just generates magnitude six earthquakes and not even thinking about it, right? So when we hear a magnitude six earthquake off the coast, we almost know, of California, we almost know where to put it blindly. So that, again, is not a very a rare event. And so I think for us in both Nevada, especially in California, our streaks in terms of a lack of a large earthquake here in Nevada has been since 1954. And you could probably, depending on how you parse it, in California, it would be really Northridge. And we're looking onwards of 25 and 50 years. So I think that's the bigger story is how do we get ready for that? the last time we had a big earthquake in either state, we didn't have handheld cell phones, right? Everybody did things in duplicate. So it's going to be a different world that we have to get accustomed to in recovery.
It's funny that you're kind of laughing, like you find some of this amusing. I can't imagine what your world is like watching these daily recordings of, as I said, multiple earthquakes happening, less than one, two, even up to three in magnitude.
Yeah, you know, for our labs, maybe a little bit different. We're involved with putting fire cameras out at a ferocious pace right now. And so we learn a lot by doing multiple hazards. So there was a big story this week about the Verizon throttling, and because occasionally we have to put a mobile camera out like we did for the ranch fire on cellular, it's not what we like to do. We already know about throttling. So I think one of the lessons that we learn is, when you're in multiple hazards, you essentially get to learn the lessons from one situation and apply it to the next. And so if there's a little bit of gallows humor is that we know already just from dealing with, early fire detection and everything involved there, that a lot of things are designed to go wrong. And so what we try to do, whether it's with earthquakes or with other hazards like fire or floods, to try to figure out how to make a system that works on the worst day and not the easy day. And so kind of that's what we're doing, waiting for the next big earthquake and getting involved with a lot of stuff that's hitting the fan, as they say, right now.
Let me get back to earthquakes in a moment. Let's stay with fires, because you've talked with us before about the fire cameras you're putting out. Explain that a little bit more and how big the network is, and then we're going to get to what you meant when you referred to what Verizon did with its communication lines.
Yeah, so we're now in four states, in California, Nevada, and parts, southern parts of Idaho and Oregon. And what we really try to do is help with early detection. And when you think about it, when somebody calls in a 911 call to your local dispatch, they still have no idea if it's a real fire. Is it blowing up? Is it just kind of setting down? It's pretty easy. And there's no real intel. And so the way that you can essentially figure out what's really going on within about 20 seconds is to have a network of cameras. And as we found out in San Diego with the Lilac Fire last December, you know, you essentially can help stop, not always, but this in case the worst fire day in San Diego history, and the camp played a critical role in throttling the Lilac Fire down to 4,000 acres. If you recall, the Thomas went large and went almost to 300,000. So, but again, this kind of providing that situational awareness is also going to be needed when there's the next big earthquake. So when you look at the Hayward scenario for the Hayward Fault in East Bay, guess what? There was $35 billion of fire damage. And so what system's going to work after the next big earthquake that then has $35 billion for the fires working thereafter? And, you know, cellular companies are not built to have that type of resilience. They're built to provide as much maximum bandwidth they can so everybody can surf the web. And so, you know, it's important as we go back and forth to try to understand limitations of data delivery. And again, so we learn it with fire, but we're applying it towards our earthquake network, and our earthquake early warning stations we're putting out in Eastern California are all on their own private microwave and not cellular.
Are any of your fire cameras in the areas that burned, the Carr Fire, the Mendocino Complex, or the Ferguson Fire?
So we were asked and were able to get a mobile camera out for the ranch fire just as it was burning down onto Clear Lake. So we just recently were awarded funds from Sonoma County Water Agency to build out a Sonoma County network. But before that actually happened, we got a request if we could put a mobile unit out. And so, yeah, we've been watching that fire for weeks and weeks now, all on Verizon Cellular, and it's been okay. Occasionally you'll see speeds go down and then go back up, but that's something that we already do.
And to clarify with Verizon, there is a difference here between lines, communication lines that are burned up in a fire versus a human decision in terms of how much capacity or bandwidth is available at the time. So we should clarify what that situation was.
Oh, absolutely. Again, there's the whole idea, again, with the North Bay fires. They lost a bunch of towers that evening back in October. And so whether you had a great plan or not, everything became very limited. Obviously, if you have an earthquake and it tears a lot of the fiber backhaul or networking that provides support to the cellular towers, that's another situation. It doesn't matter what plan you have, right? So, again, I think the lesson we've learned is if it really matters the day that earthquake happens or the day that fire happens or that flood, you can't have cellular be your primary mechanism. You're just asking for trouble.
How connected then do you see earthquakes and wildfires? I think we could add volcanoes into that too, especially if we're going to talk about Hawaii or the northwestern U.S.
Yeah, or even floods like with Oroville.
Right.
I would say, you know, from our lab's perspective, they're very interconnected. They all of these events need to have a network that works on a bad day, not on a good day. And then they get weird because on one hand, if I have a better weather network, I can predict where the fire is going to go in real time, right? And so weather can feed into fire prediction in real time, or earthquakes. About half of the damage in many simulations, at least in California, come from fireborne earthquakes, right? So the earthquake breaks the gas lines and away goes the fire. So they're really interconnected. And so we feel like for us, the best thing we can do is, like we're doing right now, is we're building out an amazing fire camera network that's out of Tahoe and moving north and south. And then we stitch in all of our earthquake early warning stations, and they're all brought back by the same mechanism. And that mechanism isn't reliant on cellular data. And we do love the cellular as a temporary thing or as a backup, but not as the primary. So we see that they're all engaged. And if you just give me one more point, which is the most important point, is when that final streak in Nevada or California is broken for the next large earthquake, seismologists are going to have to, at least some, are going to have to interact with fire people, for first responders, for getting people out of the buildings. And if you don't know any fire responder or captain or chief by their name and their phone number, that's going to be a harrowing day, because now you're meeting all these people for the first time. We already know all these people by speed dial. So when the next big earthquake happens in Nevada, we already know who we deal with because we deal with them every day.
You're listening to Dr. Graham Kent from UNR's Seismology Lab. I'm going to keep you on the phone just a few more minutes, Dr. Kent, to just go back to that Oregon magnitude 6 that you basically said happens as an everyday occurrence. On the same day, about 17, 18 hours later, one about that size happened off the coast of Alaska. Did that mean anything to you?
When I see all these, because to some degree they're all random occurrences, just if you're flipping a coin and you get, you know, six heads in a row, you know a tail's going to happen sooner or later. And so when I see all this activity or out by Fiji or Vanuatu or Indonesia, I just always pause and remember that at some point in Fiji or Vanuatu or in Indonesia, they're going to be looking back at California or Nevada. That's the thing that brings it back to sharp focus for me, is that, you know, our streaks will end. And then we're going to be judged on how well, as a whole, we respond to those earthquakes, not only the moments right after, but that recovery period for in some case, years. And so anything that we can do now to make sure that when that dot finally lands underneath one of our two states, that we're able to deal with it. I think that's really what I think about when I see this activity around the world.
And if we think that tectonic plates are just staying in place until an earthquake happens, that's not true. They're always moving, kind of shifting into each other, sliding around, aren't they? They're almost always in motion, correct?
Yeah, if you go deep enough into the crust, they're moving. It's just they get locked up tight in the shallow most part of the crust. So the big background picture of plate tectonics, they're always moving. It's just they kind of get stuck up near the surface. And the only problem with that getting stuck is that we like to build our houses right on top of where they get stuck. So again, it's not like somehow the San Andreas or the Southern San Andreas, which is 320 years out on a 180-year average, we know that streak's going to end. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And right now, it's kind of a curious scientific question of how can you sustain such a long, quiescent period, record-breaking period? But we know it's going to end. And what's more important is, can we develop that earthquake early warning signal to help people out at the moment? Are we building our buildings rugged enough to survive, or at least for occupancy safety? And more importantly, we're probably not going to have cellular for a day, a week, or a month, or water for a day, week, or months. Are we ready for that? You know, the answer is, of course, no. And so that needs to be where more attention is paid. Again, just go down to Hurricane Harvey. There was an article just, I think, yesterday where, you know, people are still, you know, cooking on their camp stoves after a year. So, again, I think in my position, it's to put out the best network, whether it's seismic or fire or whatever, but also to try to remind people that it will come and we are not anywhere near as prepared as we think we are. And if you don't believe me, just go to Italy, go to all the other places that had it. And it's quite jolting, pardon the pun. And we have to, as a society, learn to plan ahead more than a minute. And I think that's the key point.
In October is the Great Shakeout, and that's the worldwide earthquake public drill. You brought the shakeout to Nevada back in 2010, I believe. California was the first state to join. So how much does an earthquake drill help for the real thing?
You know, I think what's interesting with the shakeout, we were excited that California is like, yeah, let's get somebody else involved, and we were crazy enough to do it. And I think in the first 2, 3, 4, 5 years, it was very successful in getting people's kind of attention up. But what I've noticed lately, and I don't, you know, if your viewers have any idea, let me know. But it just kind of is getting stale a little bit. Not that it isn't an important message, but I just think people's, you know, their lives are so busy, and it's kind of like, yeah, we practiced for 5 years and it didn't happen. And so we're trying to figure out what Shakeout is. How do we kind of bring it back to the fore so people are kind of, you know, they don't get atrophied from the actual exercise. And so we're thinking of different ideas and trying to do one topic a year, like a family plan or something to kind of add a little bit of difference to the drill. But I think it's super important for people to do that basic life safety, which is drop cover and hold on. And if we can get to do that, then the lines at the emergency room are shorter. And that's the real goal there. Mm-hmm.
So to circle back around to these original statistics that sort of alerted me that the North Pacific Ocean has had, for example, 15 earthquakes in the past 24 hours. In the past year, over 44,000 earthquakes. And you're saying for right now that that's all what we would consider in the realm of normal, correct?
Yeah. So again, Nevada gets anywhere between 15 and 20,000 earthquakes a year. And at some point, one of those earthquakes is going to go large, right? And I think as we get better with monitoring, we'll see smaller earthquakes, those numbers go up. And so people should not necessarily read into every earthquake or there's 16 here or 24 there. What they have to realize is that the next big one is going to be, you know, 27,000 times more energy than the one that jolted them out of their bed a couple of years ago from some magnitude 5 or whatever, right? So, you know, it's just like a completely different scenario. And so we want people to make sure that they know how to drop cover and hold on, and then go to shakeout.org. But do you have a family plan? Where are you going to meet? It's not at your house because your house may not be there or accessible, right? Do you have food? You should have that for weather anyhow. But do you have 3 days at least of food and water? I would tell people you need a couple weeks. If you just look at the recent spate of disasters in the U.S. So it's those types of things that get them prepared, not just for an earthquake, but for a bad weather scenario or a fire, and just be more aware and more connected into the news as things happen.
All right, Dr. Kent, thanks for the update. Thanks for the information. I appreciate your time as always.
Not a problem. Have a great day.
You too. That is Dr. Graham Kent, Nevada Director of the Seismology Lab at UNR. He mentioned shakeout.org. We'll post a link to that as well. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio.